All right, welcome back to the podcast. My guest this week is Mike Hanley, director of Duo Labs at Duo Security. And I invited Mike on the podcast today to talk a little bit about some of the data that Duo put out recently regarding the current state of healthcare endpoint security. And you guys had some really interesting data points here that I want to talk about a little bit. Let's start with the source for the data. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what's the source for the data and how did you go about pulling all this stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Ryan, and thanks for having me on the podcast today. I appreciate the invitation. So a little bit about the data. So Duo runs a endpoint security and two-factor authentication service that serves several thousand customer accounts that covers a much larger population of users and several million devices, both handsets and traditional laptop and desktop endpoints. And when we look at that data over time, you know, we interact with all those endpoints several times over the course of the day as users access data and systems protected by our service. So we generate on the order of tens of millions of records a day about the health of those endpoints, what type of endpoints they are, what types of cloud services and data they might be accessing, et cetera. So get a pretty large pool of data to start from. And we were really curious to take a look specifically at the healthcare vertical and how that compares to broader trends that we have across the space.
And why healthcare? Why specifically healthcare?
Yeah, so the timing is certainly interesting. You know, we're obviously in a point right now where we see a new story about ransomware attacking hospital systems, seems like on a weekly basis. And what's particularly interesting there is not so much the ransomwares, but the economics of those attacks against the healthcare sector in particular. So generally speaking, our findings suggest the healthcare sector is slightly worse off from a security posture than many other verticals, and that these attacks are really compounded by the fact that the stakes are not simply, will we get the victim to pay or not? It's the victim will probably pay because people's lives quite literally are at risk when we attack systems that are critical to providing healthcare services to patients.
Right. It's a desperation factor. A hospital that goes down has a much, much more likelihood of being in a state of desperation and having to pay the ransoms, which is why we're starting to see that. A lot of it also ties back to hospitals running on, archaic infrastructure, a lot of old Windows XP, sometimes even older versions of Windows, and you know, some things that are out of support. Have you looked at in this pulling your data and putting this stuff together? Have you looked at the time to patch and anything associated with updating those systems?
Yeah, so like generally speaking, in healthcare specifically, we see some particularly interesting trends. So for one, the healthcare sector has about four times as many Windows XP machines as, say, the finance sector. So, and part of the reason we compared those two is primarily that they're both quite heavily regulated industries. So they have a lot of standards that they're held to with respect to not just how they operate their businesses, but how secure their information systems are. So healthcare, like I said, four times as many Windows XP machines, and we would hope that many institutions have cleared out Windows XP from their infrastructure by now, but again, not the case here.
And that's a product of the regulation environment, you think?
So I think regulation could be part of it, but also you brought up an interesting point where there's a bend towards supporting legacy applications. So a better example that I would give there is actually behavior around what types of browsers people are using. So when we look at, for example, browser platforms, back in January, Microsoft abandoned support for several versions of IE that were getting quite old. And we found that like nearly half of Internet Explorer users were actually using those flavors of Internet Explorer still. And a common alibi for that is, well, the application that I'm using doesn't render properly or doesn't support a newer version of the browser. So you have this breakdown where a business and IT decision is made for the purposes of not having to update an application or engage in any sort of compatibility updates, because that's perceived as less expensive than the cost of a breach. And in fact, there's a ton of data to support the fact that's probably not the case, and that a breach may well put you out of business, whereas you may otherwise just have to deal with a decent-sized bill to update an application. So really, the economics of that decision making are sort of being handled irrationally by a lot of these entities when they're not taking a harder look at the cost of the breach versus the cost of updating an application to use current technology with the most up-to-date security capabilities.
But that's not unique to healthcare, though. I mean, the usability and functionality versus security, usability and functionality will in most cases win because people just need to get work done properly.
Right. So, though, you know, the concerning thing certainly, though, is, like, for example, today we see about 1 in 5 healthcare customers working with our service are using, even today still, are using a non-supported version of Internet Explorer. So that's sort of a staggering statistic when you look against how many vulnerabilities are discovered in IE on like a monthly basis. Over the course of the last 3 years, on average, there have been about 150 new vulnerabilities discovered in IE each year. And nevertheless, we still see, you know, again, about 1 in 5 updates today, or 1 in 5 users today in the healthcare space using a version of IE that is so old that actually no longer gets any patches at all. So these things aren't necessarily unique patterns to healthcare, but A, they're particularly troubling in this space, and B, they're certainly worse off in a lot of these dimensions than other industry sectors.
Absolutely agree. I don't want to divert too much from the data points, but do you think, in your experience, like, you know, dealing with customers and dealing with clients, it's also a case of just difficulty migrating to something like Chrome, for instance? You know, in the security industry, Chrome is kind of considered the more secure of the browsers, auto updates itself, all that stuff. They patch vulnerabilities much quicker. You know, updating in an environment is easier than updating IE, for example. Is there a pain point with migrating from IE to Chrome in an organization?
Yeah, that's a good question, Ryan. You know, I think there's a couple considerations there. One is a lot of these healthcare institutions, and particularly the ones that we're working with, are just absolutely huge organizations. And with those comes a lot of inertia behind how they do tech, how they approach technology, and what their standard system configuration looks like. So, A, it's not as easy for them to necessarily run patches in a timely fashion, right? They may have to go through layers and layers of change control to get something like that done. And B, it might be a more difficult proposition for them to switch browser families entirely based on, you know, application compatibility concerns, say, with certain classes of healthcare providers and systems, right? We've all seen certain applications that still say today works best on IE7 with, you know, 640 by 480 screen resolution, which, you know, is absurd, but nevertheless, a lot of these larger industries might still be using an application they paid for 10 years ago that's in the same form. And, you know, on the ease of updates, this isn't unique to just browser platforms, right? So when Apple released iOS 9 several months ago, we tracked the adoption rate for that across all of our users in Duo. And within the first week, 86% of the user population hadn't run the update. So this is like a major feature release that gets a big press pitch from Apple, et cetera. And you're talking about fewer than 1 in 5 phones updates within the first week of that being available. So, and that's, you know, and that's a trivially easy update mechanism for a user to run through.
All of that makes sense to me, except for one little data point in your release here, which is that twice as many healthcare endpoints have Flash installed, and three times have Java installed on devices. And I'm guessing there's no business need for Flash. There's no sort of app compatibility issue around having Flash or Java installed on those devices or machines. Any guess as to why, or is it just, you know, just poor hygiene?
Yeah, so I think Java actually may be more popular based on some of the like healthcare IS systems that are popular today. So I do think that's a potential linkage there. There's less of a reasonable alibi for things like Flash. You know, again, similar to the earlier case about really old flavors of Internet Explorer. I mean, there's a documented history of sort of wildly exploitable vulnerabilities coming out in volumes from month to month. So I think there's less of a sane business case for Flash on those devices, but I do think Java might actually be related to some of the enterprise healthcare IS systems that are available. Now, that said, it's certainly a risk that a lot of those organizations take, and then again, that's compounded by maybe using an outdated browser and an outdated operating system. It's just one more thing that substantially increases their exposure to a motivated attacker.
Right, but why would healthcare have twice more likely to have Flash installed? Is there like some sort of web app or some sort of electronic system requiring it? I'm just trying to understand why would an IT department in a healthcare
institution... Yeah, yeah. So sure. I mean, it's a fair question. I mean, I don't know enough about the minutia of what the system requirements are for some of the more popular healthcare information systems, but that's a hypothesis that we've made based on who some of our larger healthcare systems are and what type of HRISs that we know that they use.
And if we can go back to Windows XP versus more modern versions of the operating system, Windows 10, even, you know, Windows 7, that also is an app compat scenario, right?
Most likely, it's easy to point the finger at regulation in a lot of these cases, and while that might be part of the story, that generally only applies in certain cases where, for example, the devices have to be certified to actually administer, for example, like a treatment, or whether or not they actually touch a human. So I don't think it's enough of a pass to say, oh well, for regulatory reasons we have to stay on Windows XP. But certainly those are still systems that potentially house patient data, and there's certainly nothing that says you should run an out of date and insecure operating system that's housing patient data. So when we see, you know, A, that healthcare has four times as many Windows XP machines than, say, the financial sector, or that the financial sector has 50% more Windows 10 operating system hosts than the healthcare sector, and those are pretty large disparities. And granted, in healthcare, the most popular operating system is Windows 7, but this is still a flavor of Windows that, while popular, is many, many years old, and the Windows ecosystem has certainly improved leaps and bounds in security over time leading up to Windows 10.
Did you deep dive into patch levels on those Windows systems, on those Windows 7 systems?
So we generally don't dive into the individual patch levels for a lot of the Windows systems, but one of the things that we generally will infer, though, is that because the update path, especially for Windows 10, has been made so streamlined at this point, I mean, really, it's almost hard to avoid automatic update to Windows 10 in all but heavily managed environments, that we do find concern that potentially some of these systems maybe aren't running Windows Update based on the fact that they're not using current browsers, and that they're not running the most current release of the Windows family.
Do you get a sense, and this might not be something you can pull from the data set, but do you get a sense that employee user education in the healthcare sector is weaker than other sectors? People are more likely to click on things. People are more likely to, just manage their computers poorly.
That's a great question. I don't have an answer to that necessarily in the data, but I would draw this inference. So what I think is particularly challenging with healthcare is, it's an industry that's in super high demand. It's high velocity. You know, doctors' offices are potentially seeing tens or hundreds of patients a day, and they're moving so fast that it would be easier to dismiss a lot of the security fundamentals for the sake of throughput. And that's tough. I mean, that's a business problem that ultimately they have to kind of do the risk calculus there and decide what protections they're going to take versus how many fewer patients that they'll see as a result of that. So clearly, if you're a bad guy, this is something you take into account when you think about who you're going to target. So it's not so much that ransomware, you know, to tie it back to the news stories of today, it's not so much that ransomware in itself is unique or interesting, or that it's particularly interesting even in the healthcare sector. What's interesting is that the attackers have found good alignment with basically what's the lowest hanging fruit and what's the victim population that has the most sort of inelastic demand for requiring access to their computers. So basically we're saying, who can tolerate this the least and who are we most likely to have success with? And, that's tough because the attackers have figured this out. And now the healthcare providers and their IT shops are playing catch-up as a result.
And that's assuming they have IT shops, because a lot of these small mom-and-pop doctors' offices don't have an IT guy.
It's completely fair. I recall a situation about a year ago going into my eye doctor's office and seeing all the warnings about running unsecured Wi-Fi on the desktop that was in the room. So I certainly can appreciate that. And you know, I'll go back and make one other clarifying statement on that too, which is the methods behind this aren't unique to the healthcare sector either. I mean, ransomware attacks in healthcare don't necessarily require you to have some sort of special sauce that works in a hospital system and not in a bank per se. It's really just, again, it's attackers are rational actors. They're looking for the highest return for the least amount of work. That's exactly where this goes. The stakes are high. They know it's much more likely that they're going to be able to get these victims to pay, et cetera. And it's, you know, the days of, you know, and for anyone who's surprised by ransomware, I mean, the days of popping computers for the purposes of laughs or claiming credit are long, long dead, despite the fact that that still gets brought up as a reason periodically for doing so. It's really all about how do I monetize those actions. And this is really prime real estate right now for bad guys.
And we don't really have any evidence that the ransomware attacks against hospitals and healthcare are targeted either. They just might be hitting and spraying, and those are like, based on your, you know, the details in your data, they just might be the low-hanging fruit. So there's no evidence that they're, you know, specifically targeted to those hospitals.
Yeah, while it may be the case that some of them are targeted, you know, for example, I mean, to your point, right, it's I want to get as much as I can for sort of one shot or one set of infrastructure that I have set up as an attacker. But again, it's a small healthcare system, a large healthcare system, where they're geographically located, not sure it necessarily matters. I think you're probably going to have a pretty high hit rate no matter what as a bad guy. And you know, frankly, hospitals having to pay the attackers suggests that this is a fruitful opportunity, right? I mean, we've had several instances in the news where they have reported paying, you know, that I think is an encouragement to the attackers and lets them know they're on the right path.
All right, let's just finish up with some security recommendations. Do you have, top five bullet points? Let's keep it in the healthcare sector of top five bullet points for what, you know, whether it's mom and pop or a large hospital with an IT department, the top five things they should be doing as a priority to, you know, prepare for or even help with recovery from one of these attacks?
Yeah, sure. So the first and foremost thing, and this analogy relates well, I think, to healthcare, is we really preach security hygiene at Duo. So it's we really want to get back to the basics of doing things like washing your hands. And, you know, it's something you do each and every time before a doctor interaction with a patient. It's something we want the security industry to adopt as well, where it's I'm always running automatic updates. I'm always defaulting to a secure configuration. And taking those basic behaviors that we know to be highly effective first. So that's sort of the first thing. The second is certainly to enhance security awareness training. You brought up a point earlier that, you know, are potentially customers at these sites making riskier choices. And the best way for us to work on defeating that is to continue to raise awareness about the types of these campaigns, the types of phishing emails that are sent through that are eventually going to become the bait, so to speak, for people to click through to download these ransomware kits. So generating that awareness is really critical. The third thing that I would recommend as well is understanding strong identity of who has your systems. So, you know, Duo is a two-factor authentication provider, but even abstracted from that, you need to understand who has access to systems and data and control that with really, really strong authentication of who your user population is, so you can quickly identify someone who's not supposed to be there. Those are sort of the top three highlights. I mean, again, it's mostly surrounding security hygiene and making, you know, making it significantly harder with sort of the most basic elements for an adversary to get in. It's not to say that there's not value in some more niche solutions, but in the security space, as I'm sure you appreciate, we do have a tendency to get this shiny object syndrome, and there can be a tendency to go toward a more attractive solution that has flashing lights on it, versus doing the things that we know work the best, but maybe aren't the most attractive or compelling things to talk about. And I mean, this makes us sound a little fuddy-duddy, right? Like we're no fun here, but we really do want to fall back on the things that we know are going to be most effective, so we can make cost-effective choices about security and risk mitigation, and recommend those things to our customers.
One thing I forgot to ask, and it might tie into, you know, the talk about managing identity, is there a high incidence of BYOD, people using their own devices in healthcare, people taking work home to do in healthcare versus any other sector?
Yeah, so we don't necessarily distinguish between managed devices and unmanaged devices for purposes of pulling this data together, though there's a lot of evidence to suggest there is a fair amount of work from home and mobile platform utilization across all sectors, healthcare included. So this is everything from using like your personal iPhone or Android device to tablets at home to personal computers, et cetera. There's also in healthcare what I think is maybe a more interesting trend is you have a large number of third-party contractors who are all accessing healthcare systems data that's stored, for example, in one cloud service. So we might see, you know, for a healthcare system, say in the state of Indiana, we might see any number of third-party contractors coming in from other states or other countries accessing data in those same cloud repositories for purposes of payment processing, insurance information, healthcare analytics, supplies, etc. And that I think suggests BYOD, if you abstract that to say devices that are not mine or that were not issued by the hospital, then yes, we absolutely see a huge volume of that in those spaces.
Thank you very much, Mike. Appreciate the time.
Great. Thanks, Ryan.